Well, a big thanks to Darren and the team for driving us through the afternoon. It is Monday, April 14th, and you are listening to Game On with me, Shane Dawson, alongside Ruby Walsh.
And coming up between now and the new music show at 7 o'clock, we'll reflect on Rory McIlroy's historic Masters win as the Hollywood hero achieves sporting immortality. More on that shortly.
Elsewhere, Alan Collier standing by to chat Premier League and League of Ireland, while Austin O'Malley reflects on the weekend's championship action. If you want to have your say, you can get in touch on WhatsApp 087 187 9200, text 51552, or find us on X at GameOn2FM.
This is 2FM's Game On.
Evening, Ruby.
How are you, Shane? How are you?
Very well. And catch your eye over the weekend?
Bits and pieces here and there. Mind you, the weekend was over by the time I went to bed.
That's very much true. Alan Colley, Austin O'Malley, decent weekend of sport.
Quite enough.
Yeah, nothing much breaking really, was there?
Ockram was decent, wasn't
Ockram
it?
Ockram was rocking, actually, yeah. The Dubs were there in force. It was an experience.
Well, gentlemen, let us just dive straight into the headline news. Rory McIlroy ending his major drought in barely believable fashion by beating Justin Rose in a playoff to win the 89th Masters and indeed complete the career Grand Slam. Let us remind ourselves of Rory's major wins.
Now this will finish off a dream week for a 22-year-old. States Open champion.
Time margin of victory in PGA Championship history
to break Nicklaus's record of 7. Can it be? Yes! The new ruler of the game of golf is Rory McIlroy.
Oh, what a display today on the greens. That is 24 putts for 18 greens.
And here we go to close out the year in major championship golf. This is going to be your player of the year. And we have a shining star at sunset. Rory continues his run to greatness.
Shadows. Symbolic at this moment. But the journey it's taken to get here. For all this history.
The long journey is over. McIlroy has his masterpiece.
To be listed alongside those five others, Tiger, Jack, Gary, Ben Hogan, Gene Sarazen. I mean, they're, you know, when Tiger won the Grand Slam back in 2000 or whatever it is, I think it was 25 years ago. So, you know, to be the first player in 25 years to do it, you know, that means a lot to me.
Nice.
Greg Allen, 25 years since somebody completed the Grand Slam. I'm sure you must have been privileged, honoured, delighted to have been in Augusta yesterday.
Oh, yeah. And I was there in 2000 when Tiger did it. And, you know, in most of our lifetime, certainly in your lifetime, there's only been Jack Nicklaus in 1966. Yeah, I was around when that happened, but I don't remember it, obviously. So I only remember Tiger and obviously yesterday to be there to see an Irishman wear the green jacket and what it meant, not just in terms of his desire to win that green jacket after the, you know, tumultuous disappointment of 2011 when he had a four-shot lead going into the final round and had a terrible meltdown on the back nine. And then knowing that since 2015, the Masters in April of 2015, that was the first time when the career Grand Slam was a possibility for him. And 10 years coming to Augusta, Rory was asked the question almost every single year, you know, what about the career Grand Slam? The first major of the year with the pent-up anticipation ahead of it for 7 or 8 months beforehand, because it hasn't been a major since last July or August, depending on whether the USPGA was in August or July or May, or I should say in the last 10 years. There has been this, you know, pent-up anticipation, huge tension. It was a burden. He mentioned that word yesterday. And now it's all gone. Like, to be there, to see him just lighter, you know, he just looks like a man who's got a weight lifted off his shoulders. I don't think anybody could deny that what happened on the 18th green. Have there been ever scenes like that in golf? I haven't witnessed them. There may well have been. I know that Tiger Woods had an explosive, you know, celebration in 2019 when he obviously, you know, bridged a gap back to 2008 since his previous major championship victory. Yes, that was close. I don't think it was as big an explosion of emotion as we saw last night, because Rory has been pilloried with questions about his character in terms of under pressure. Could he deal with it? Could he deliver? And that's all gone now. And the difference between Tiger in 2019, when Tiger was 43, is that Rory is 35. He could still have his very, very best years of golf ahead of him. And we now know that with the burden lifted, that he could achieve great things. He could go on to 6, 7, 8, 9 majors. And I think that he will go on to 7 or 8. And I think he will surpass Nick Faldo and become the greatest European player in history without question. Currently, as the only European career Grand Slam winner, he may well be regarded as that. But to truly, you know, achieve the greatest European player in history, he has to go at least level with Nick Faldo at 6 majors. And that could happen next month, Ruby, because he goes to Quail Hollow, where he's won 4 times in the Wells Fargo Championship. And he knows how to get the job done around there. And the USPGA Championship is going to be staged there. And that major is only a month away. We could have another big goal set and achieved for Rory McIlroy in a month's time if he goes on to 6 major championship victories and level with Nick Faldo at the top of the charts, so to speak.
And it would be incredible. It would be amazing to watch. And it would just be... I think it would justify the player, justify the man in Rory McIlroy. But Greg, what about the roller coaster yesterday? The after back nine yesterday. I mean, up, down, up, down. God, it was so hard to watch it. How did he do it?
I think there's a very interesting thing which I just heard on the No Laying Up podcast, where Hunter Mahan, the American Ryder Cup player, texted one of the No Laying Up podcast guys to say that on the back nine, this was the most resilient mental round he had ever witnessed. And there was some laughing about it. Sure, how could it be mentally resilient? There was Rory throwing shots away. And what Hunter Mahan meant by that was, yes, he was throwing it away, but then he'd bounce back. It's like he got hit by punches, but came up off the ropes swinging. So, for example, Rory got lucky on 11. The ball didn't go into the water on 11 from his recovery shot from the trees. That was a stroke of luck. He hit the 12th green, safe par there. So now he's got a 3-shot lead coming down 13. And it looks as though, you know, he should be able to navigate his way in from here, because other players were falling away. Only Justin Rose was emerging from the pack. And Rory on the 13th is an 86-yard wedge. He has 15 yards of green to the left of the flag where he can aim, because the slope will funnel the ball down towards the flag if he aims at that. There was no need to shoot anything with that wedge in his hand, or three-quarter wedge in his hand, that was in any way ambitious. Just make par, keep making pars, and you'll win. But he didn't. He dumped the ball into Ray's Creek. I mean, it was an inexplicably bad shot, a terrible shot. But what it was a shot that showed how nervous he was. He couldn't get rid of the nerves that he felt on the first tee. And he said he was extraordinarily nervous on the first tee. The reason he took double bogey down the first was because of those nerves. And he actually felt a release of those nerves when he walked off with a double bogey in the first. And although he had double bogeyed the hole, he actually felt that he had, you know, at least got himself into the round. And, well, it's up and running now. I can recover from that double bogey because I've got 17 holes ahead. And within four holes, he was three shots ahead of the field. And that was the way the Masters went. And then on the back nine, all of those things that happened were just sucker punches, you would have thought. And yet he kept bouncing back. On the 15th, it may go down as one of the greatest shots in the history of the Masters. The 7-iron over 200 yards, bent around the trees, landing 6 feet away. Oh, yes, he didn't hold the putt, but he got the birdie. It put him one in front. And then the fantastic iron shots on 16, then on 17 to 3 feet. And then he's flawed again on 18, missing the green from 124 yards. 124 yards, taking four to get down. And then it goes into the playoff. And then in the playoff, he comes back again off the ropes, swinging, and hits the most sublime drive, a brilliant wedge, and obviously a three-foot putt in the center of the hole, and it's all over. That's why it was so mentally resilient. Not because he made mistakes, but because he came back from the mistakes.
He most certainly did, Greg. You have a flight to catch even, and the memories of that will make it a short flight home. Thanks a million for fitting us in.
Not at all, Ruby. Only a pleasure.
We appreciate it, Greg Allen. Let us hear from the man himself. Rory McIlroy was speaking to Greg after that historic victory yesterday.
Rory McIlroy, here you are wearing a green jacket. Dreams come true. How about that? Dreams come true. 17 times trying. What does this feel like right now to have gone through all the protocols that follow winning the Masters?
Yeah, it feels absolutely incredible. It's been a long time coming. Every year that I come here and I drive down Magnolia Lane, I try to bring the best attitude that I can, and I try to prepare as diligently as possible. And sometimes I've been able to produce, you know, close to my best golf, but not be able to get the job done. And, you know, thankfully this year was a little bit different. I came in a great vein of form, you know, winning a couple of times, you know, winning the Players' Championship a couple of weeks ago. And I don't feel like I'd ever felt like my confidence was as high as coming in here. I felt like I was ready for anything that this course and this tournament would throw at me. And thankfully I was proved right, because it threw a lot at me today.
What it threw at you today was your lead of two strokes was gone after one hole. You said in the press conference that somehow that kind of settled you. How?
Yeah. I felt like this sense of, I was very nervous playing the first hole. And I felt this sense of calmness walking to the second. I don't really know how to describe that, but it was like, okay, we've got off to start, not a good start, but at least we're off and running, and I can settle into the round. You know, it didn't help that, you know, I wasn't able to birdie the second, and Bryson did, and all of a sudden, you know, that two shot lead had went into a one shot disadvantage. But I think the third hole today was as important as any in, you know, being able to make a birdie there and Bryson bogeying, so that, you know, that two shot swing, and then the same happening on the next hole, you know, to go from one behind playing the third hole to three ahead playing the fifth was a massive swing after the, you know, the start. So I just, you know, I really was able to steady the ship, and you know, once I got into the round and just got into, you know, my flow of what I do and being in the right thought processes, you know, I felt like, you know, for the most part, I handled myself pretty well after that.
But you put everyone, yourself especially, through the ringer. I mean, absolute, you know, the two double bogeys, the three bogeys, and yet you came swinging off the ropes, six birdies, and some of them were absolutely perfectly timed. 15, for example, when you hit a 7-iron, 20 yards of movement through the air to 6 feet, and suddenly you were back.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, for as what I feel as cruel as 15 was to me on the first day, it was very good to me after that. You know, the way I played the 15th hole Friday, Saturday and Sunday, playing it in 4-under in those 3 days, you know, the 2-iron shots I hit at the weekend, the 6-iron on Saturday, the 7-iron today. Yeah, you know, look, they were pivotal golf shots in the tournament, and it really got me back into it. And I was a little fortunate that I was able to see Bryson's ball in the air on 15 today, and he came up short in the water. I was originally going to hit an 8-iron, and I switched to a 7. I was fortunate that had happened, and was able to hit a really good shot and make a birdie there.
Now you're a career Grand Slamist. You're a legend of the game. Whether you might be modest about that or not, you are. You've joined that pantheon of greats, those five men who hold the career Grand Slam. What does that mean to you? What does it mean to you to be the Masters champion as well? I mean, do you equate one higher than the other? Or do you separate them in your career of dreams?
I've said this before, but I feel like my last major was so long ago that, you know, it felt like I was striving to just win my first again at some point. So to be able to get over the line, to get over that hurdle, especially here, given that everything that comes along with a Masters week for me, you know, that's incredibly satisfying. And yeah, you know, to be listed alongside those five others and Tiger, Jack, Gary, Ben Hogan, Gene Sarazen. I mean, they're, you know, when Tiger won the Grand Slam back in 2000 or whatever it is, I think it was 25 years ago. So, you know, but to be the first player in 25 years to do it, you know, that means a lot to me.
On 18, you collapsed to the ground. The relief was palpable. The joy was somewhat unfolding after the relief. For you, what does it mean to have taken this burden off your shoulders? Because everybody has followed your story.
I can certainly drive down Magnolia Lane a little more free next year. Knowing that I'm able to come back here each and every year. I've got the Grand Slam monkey off my back. I've got the, you know, when's Rory going to win his next major off. You know, all of that is gone, which is so nice to be able to turn up to these big events and not have to answer those questions, not have to go through that anymore. And honestly, you know, with the way I'm playing, the way I'm feeling about my game, you know, I feel like this could be the start of some really good things.
You've also, just to say something that I know means a lot to you, that you have Harry Diamond on your bag, your boyhood friend. To win with him on the bag the way you won, what has that been for you?
Yeah, Harry has been absolutely amazing. You know, look, we've went through a lot of highs and a few lows over the course of our however long he's been on the bag, seven nearly 8 years. We've wanted this major championship for so long. You know, we've had opportunities, we haven't quite gotten it done, but to stride up that 18th hole here at Augusta National with him beside me, I celebrate with, you know, that in itself is a dream come true for two lads from Hollywood, Northern Ireland. And yeah, I'm just so happy that I was able to do it with him today.
Congratulations on an extraordinary achievement. You're the Masters champion and a career Grand Slam winner.
Thank you.
Rory McIlroy speaking to Greg Allen there. Well, from one great Irish golfer to another, I am delighted to say Paul McGinley joins us on the line now. Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to chat to us here on Game On. You were there, yeah, obviously, and it was an absolute emotional roller coaster watching on. And I know you referenced it, the human story of redemption. Is Rory's biggest achievement, in a way, almost defeating Rory himself? Never mind Bryson or Justin Rose. It was a case of banishing the ghosts of the past and overcoming his demons.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. I think anybody who's been following Rory for the last 11 years in his trials and tribulations of trying to get over line and winning another major championship again, when, you know, he was for most of the time the top player in the game, and he was winning titles all the way around the world, and winning money titles, not just in Europe, but in America too. And the one thing that was eluding him more than anything was these majors, and it was scar tissue when he had given himself a number of chances and it let it slip through his fingers for one reason or another. The one thing above all that he wanted was the green jacket and complete the Grand Slam. So to do it all at once was something special. So that's the background to it. And then the second part of it is to do it the way he did yesterday during the round. I mean, there's ways to win tournaments and there's ways to win tournaments. And to show, can I say, the balls that he showed yesterday to come back from three times being, looked like he'd blown it and was absolutely on the floor like a boxer. He was after taking a heavyweight blow. Could he get up again and throw another punch? And he did. That's, you know, that when I talk about the human part of it, that's what I mean. The backstory, and then also then in a small microcosm of what he did yesterday in yesterday's round.
Paul, when you watch Rory McIlroy with a golf club, and what he can do when his back is to the wall, when he's chasing, when he has to find a birdie. Is he a better golfer when he's just playing to win rather than just trying to defend a lead?
Yes, Ruby, you'd know all about that. Chasing from behind. I think he's best on the front foot. And looking at it yesterday, when he tried to defend yesterday, the 13th hole, for example, a par five, is comfortably on a two from even after an average drive at 240. That's not a long distance for Rory anymore. He probably could have got there with maybe a two iron or a three iron and decided to lay up and then, you know, having hitting the next shot in the water. And then when he made that mistake and then also bogeyed 14, he gets on the front foot again at 15, and it's one of the best shots ever in Masters history. It's just incredible. It really is. The resilience that he showed, the ability to reset and pull off some unbelievable shots on the back of you know, losing the initiative in the tournament, considering all that was at stake, that takes something special. It really does. That's the best mental, as good, and I'm a huge lover of sport. That's as big an achievement yesterday in sport that I've ever seen, because of the body blows that he took during the round.
I agree with you. Even on the playoff hole, when Justin Rose puts it in the middle of the green,
that's right,
he goes and puts it inside him. I mean, that's standing that's up right. and being counted.
Absolutely. Particularly when it's the exact same yardage as when he was in original play and he hit the same club from the same yardage 25 yards further right and into the bunker and made bogey. But Justin going first forced him on the front foot. Would have been interesting if Rory would have hit that in first. If Rory had been to play first, you know, would he have been as aggressive with that pitch shot? Justin forced his hand.
He did. Is there any way of forcing Rory's hand all the time? Of convincing him, just keep going for it.
Well, you know, we have a player in the game at the moment who's the number one player in Scotty Scheffler. And he plays a very measured game, a very poised game. He's very good at every aspect of the game. He moved the ball comfortably right to left. He's not one of the overall big hitters, even though he's a big guy at 6'4". He's a brilliant putter. He's a brilliant chipper, bunker play, he's got a real stoic personality about him. But he doesn't have the charisma of watching Rory McIlroy play. He's like a magnet. And Rory's always been like that since he's come on. Yes, he crashes and burns every now and again. But boy, when he's in full throttle, he's amazing to watch. It's Tiger-esque when he's in full flow. And that's what makes him so magnetic and why people love to watch him and why we have such a bounce in viewing figures on Sky when he's in contention. And you know, we get criticised on Sky for being on the Rory fan club and Rory, Rory, Rory. But, I mean, our viewing figures just pop. And all our market research shows that everybody wants to hear and talk and know about Rory McIlroy. And it's been like that for quite a while, because that's the way he plays the game. That swashbuckling style, a bit like Seve Ballesteros, a bit like Tiger Woods when he was on the chase. And that's what makes sports so enthralling, when somebody's in full flow.
Paul, we talk about the significance of completing that career Grand Slam, and Greg Allen was on earlier and he mentioned that perhaps Rory's best years might be ahead of him. He could surpass Nick Faldo, could be the greatest European. How much does this free Rory up? His gameplay as well, like, it will physically loosen the shoulders up as well, not only mentally, but going forward now, this could be just so significant for his career in the future.
You would think that it does. I mean, nothing is ever a given in sport, and you know, barring injuries, such wood, that doesn't happen to him. But you would think that it does, now that kind of pressure release valve of 11 years of pent-up emotion and angst and scar tissue has been released. You would hope that now there's going to be a freedom at how he's going to play. A couple of things I'd say, though, too. When he won his first majors in 2012, 13, 14, there was a vacuum in the game. Tiger Woods was coming off his perch. And Ernie Els was kind of not the player he was. David Duval was not the player he was. And there was a bit of a vacuum in the game. There was nobody really stepping up. And Rory came onto the scene with this swashbuckling style where he hit it further than anybody else, including Tiger, and took a golf course and wrestled it to its knees and overpowered it and had these pointy elbows. Get out of my way. I'm making my mark in this game. Watch me go. And he rose very quickly to become the number one player in the world. And then what happened over the next 6 or 7 years, or even 10 years, was that a number of players stepped up when they saw the style of golf that he played. They worked harder in the gym. They looked for speed. they realized that that big hitting was going to be a huge advantage, and everybody chased this. And so he kind of he was a pioneer in that regard. Because he's not a big guy in stature, but he had this amazing ability to hit the ball a million miles. And guys realized that, you know, maybe you might not have the physical strength or the physical size, but you can still, you know, generate speed somehow. So the game kind of changed in that way. So his competition became stronger. Now, from where he is going forward, to answer your question, because he's still one of the biggest hitters in the game, and there's maybe he's certainly in the top three biggest hitters on the PGA Tour and in the game, he's got a game that will last into his 40s, barring injury. Even if he comes off the boil and old father time comes in and takes a little bit of distance away from him as he gets a bit older and tightens up a bit and he moves into his 40s, even if he lost a little bit of yardage, he still would have a game that's very, very applicable to what the modern game would be. He'll still be hitting the ball a million miles and good enough to be able to play the game that you're going to have to play in the next number of years. So there is no reason, from a technical point of view, from an age point of view, and now from a pressure point of view, that the pressure has been released somewhat, that he can't keep going. But as Ruby will tell you, nothing's ever given in sport.
Nothing's ever given. Paul McGinley, before we let you go, one small question on yourself. Did you enjoy working on that golf last night?
Oh, how could you not? I had a very busy week. I work a lot with American TV now, NBC. So I was bobbing and weaving between the two. And I had a very busy schedule. But how could you not? You know, when you're emotionally involved as well, too. And, you know, I spent a lot of time with Rory earlier this year. I was working as part of his TGL team. I did a lot of clinics with him and being around him for all of those games. So I've seen a lot of him. I knew where he was at. I could see his game trending. I'd see where his mindset was. And I just so wanted him to get over the line with this. And I feel more for Rory the human than I do for Rory the golfer with this victory, because I know what it means to him. And I know from how far back he's come. And I know how much criticism he's faced over the years. And I'm just thrilled that it's worked out well for him and that he's getting all the plaudits he deserves, because it really was something special. And to be the sixth player in the history of golf to ever complete the Grand Slam. Just think about that. Six players, only the second person since Tiger Woods and the only person outside of Tiger Woods in 59 years to complete the Grand Slam. And he's from our little island in Ireland. It warms the heart.
It is absolutely remarkable. Paul McGinley, thank you so much for taking our call this evening.
So we still have Alan Colley and Austin O'Malley with us to chat Association football and indeed Gaelic football, but we are continuing our Rory McIlroy chat. And just, Austin, if I come to you first on what Paul was mentioning there and indeed what Greg Allen was saying there, and with your sports psychology hat on, I suppose, Austin, as opposed to your Gaelic football punditry hat or managerial hat on, is the vulnerability the most relatable aspect to it? I'd say he's an absolute dream for a body language expert. Just viewing him last night, it was just absolutely incredible in that regard.
Yeah, no, he's really a compelling watch, and he has been for, you know, so many years. And like, he's studying himself when you look at him, and like, Rory is quite open in terms of what he gives away, maybe even pre-competition and post-competition, and he's quite open and he trades quite a lot, and you can get a good, I suppose, sort of window into his mind where he's at. And sometimes we've often probably said in the past that maybe he should keep a little bit more to himself, but that's the nature of the guy, and that's I suppose how kind of authentic he is and the human side of it, and that's, I suppose, in terms of the way he connects with people as well. But I suppose just from a performance perspective, watching it play out yesterday and watching from, you know, obviously the hardships and the struggles that he's gone through previously, yesterday, like, was really an exhibition and type of self-mastery. And I think in terms of when you look at it, like, the Masters is a battle in self-mastery, and the amount of times that he had to go internal there and reset, and the boys have mentioned it there in terms of rebounding and reframing after double bogeys and so on. Like, there's so much in that in terms of the cauldron that he was operating in. It's just a cauldron of chaos. So, like, I'm sure he has worked an awful lot on the mental side of his game, and I know he's working with Dr. Bob Rotella, who's a legend within the game. I think he's had fingerprints maybe on nearly 75 Masters between female and male. So the idea of that, even, you know, hear him talking there about, you know, how nervous he was, and he was able to reframe and he felt very calm again. So it's clearly that, you know, he has, I'd say, invested heavily in terms of having these little mental tools that he can go to and these processes that he can go to. And I suppose, you know, to having a kind of a mental iron to go to in these moments for himself as well. So that's huge. Like, and I just think coming out of this, you know, he has had his trials and tribulations, and you can hear him there even, and he's again so honest, but you could almost say he was a little bit mentally kind of constipated over the last number of years. He was carrying this in the back of his mind, almost, we often call it like a performance inhibitor, that it's a little anchor in your subconscious mind that he couldn't get over the line, but he has that release now, and you'd think that this would now become like a propeller for him to drive him on and to go on to greater things. But I also think coming out of this, just as a spectacle from a sports perspective and a performance perspective, he's a thrilling watch, but like, he's almost a case study, and it would be a brilliant case study to take, and I think it should nearly be run out in every school to any young sports person or anyone in society that, you know, has had hard times and that has, you know, really dug in, and to show the value in that in terms of having, you know, a purpose and a deep belief and, you know, a real passion for what you do, and to stay the course and to ultimately get across the line. So I just think it's fascinating from that perspective. There are always, throughout the history of sport, there are always great stories where, you know, the contender finally gets across the line. But I think this is a brilliant one, just to see what you would arguably call probably a generational talent was minted into a global kind of icon yesterday, and he's reached that pantheon of great. So just a thrilling watch, you know, and it's so emotional, and it's brilliant to see it. And again, obviously, the Irish connection.
Austin, did he just not yesterday stop becoming afraid of losing and try to win?
Yeah, I think there was probably, he had a moment somewhere coming down on that back nine where he again, it's a round opportunity that he decided to go for it. And it's clear that you've spoken about it there, that he is better on the front foot when he goes for it.
Is that not every sports person?
Yeah, it is. And often sometimes guys, obviously the biggest thing in any of those is guys that overthink it and girls that overthink it. And sometimes the longer you're around, the more noise that's around you, and the more that kind of creeps in, and you have to go back to basics. And that's why I think, you know, sometimes somebody comes in and they work with a sports psychologist and they think that it's, you know, a very, very kind of deep burn. But sometimes it's just the idea of really simplifying things and bringing it back to basics. And it's only sometimes maybe having a guy or girl that you're able to map that out for them, to give them a couple little tools that just come back to basics, trust yourself, re-energize yourself and go again. And sometimes it can be as simple as that. And I think for Rory, looking at him, I think just the simpler he keeps it, the better he is, you know, and to trust his stuff and to trust his ability, and you know, that's when he's at his best. I think that's when he's, when Rory's flowing and he's locked in, that's when he's at his best, when he's on a front foot, you know.
Do you ever doubt him, Al?
Will we share the text, Ruby? Will we share?
Go on, Al.
I actually did doubt him, yeah, I'll be honest, over the years, just not in terms of his ability.
I meant last night now.
I did, but I think that shows the character, and I think that's, like, obviously you've discussed it there with Paul and Austin as well. And everybody speaks, and we all obviously have, maybe if you have kids involved in sport now, or you've been involved as a kid yourself in the development of the game, and everybody might focus on the talent. And talent is one thing in terms of maybe getting you to a point, but so much about sport is what happens between the years. And I think last night was a major victory for mentality and resilience and character and all those things that you hear kind of attributed to sports people. But certainly in terms of last night, as Austin said, almost like a case study of watching those last nine holes. And Ruby, we were over and back with the text almost kind of hole by hole. And it was just such a compelling and fascinating watch, really. And I did doubt him, I have to say. And I know he'll never have to worry about this kind of question. But imagine if he never got if he didn't get the job done, how would you ever come back from that? Because he was literally like a boxer who was knocked down 2-3 times when you think you had the fight sewn up. So for him to bounce back, and I know you said it to me a few times, Ruby, and you've said it often before many times, and you asked Paul McGinley the question, and you asked Austin there now, and you're really kind of hell bent on the whole kind of front foot approach and playing to win. But isn't it amazing in every sport, just the psychology that enters people's heads? And we see it in my own sport, when you're a goal up and you retreat back all of a sudden, and it's almost like you don't even realise you're doing it, but that's what happens.
It is every sport. I watch Kerry doing it in All-Ireland. You can watch it happening in soccer. I see it happening in racing. It's every sport. And when it gets close to the end, whoever's in front starts defending.
Yeah, and it's like, as I said, I'm sure Bob Rotella, or you could speak to all the best psychologists in the world, and I'm sure everybody's tried to come up with answers for that. But humans, they're humans, Ruby, you know, and he's a human. And I think that's the lovely side of what we've seen with McIlroy. At times you look at Tiger Woods and almost think he's like a machine. But we saw the human.
That vulnerability. That's what I love so much about it. Yeah. And that's even as a spectator. I know we all love our sport here. People are listening into the show because they enjoy sport. And that's what, I'm not the biggest golf fan. I'm not the biggest Rory McIlroy. I'll admit that. If you were, it would have been absolutely chaos. But I was absolutely gripped just because of what was unfolding and how he coped with that. Like, I'm surrounded by the three of you who've all played sports at the top level, all professionally, or for the love of it in terms of Gaelic football, but professionally and all, but everything else. Like, of how you overcome that, or any sports person overcomes that, or even at a junior level. Like, I mean, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but what's the most nervous you've ever been, Ruby, in a race or coming up to a particular fence? Or
probably caught us there in a 2007 Gold Cup when he was bidding for his first Gold Cup. But I went through it every which way and eventually taught myself around to the fact that at the end of the day, it's horse race. He's either going to win or lose. He's going to jump or he's going to fall. So stop worrying about it. But like, to me, it was always... And Shane, I got loads of falls because I was too brave and I rode on the edge. But I was a big believer in riding to win. Never trying not to lose. That's the one thing that baffles me in sport. For people that just... if I was Harry Diamond, I'd be telling Rory... I'd be giving out to Rory McIlroy that he wasn't breaking the course record. Well, I'd be challenging him every step of the way.
There was a lovely thing as well, Ruby. Two or three things stuck out massively for me throughout the whole day. One was right at the start, and even before they teed off, and Ruby probably could relate to this in some ways. I certainly couldn't. I'm sure Austin couldn't, Shane, you couldn't, or anybody watching on. Just in terms of, nobody will ever know the pressure that he was on.
It's the pressure of expectation.
But Ruby, you think of what was at stake yesterday. Gone 11 years of not getting it done. People being labelled as people were labelling him as a choker, a bottler, whatever. All the stuff he's gone through over the years, different things. And for him to just even, he said it himself, the double bogey helped him. The nerves were unbelievable. He says, after the first hole, I actually walked off thinking, grand, we're in the round where I'm up and running, because the nerves, he just couldn't cope with the nerves. Like, it was unbelievable for him.
And then he's one down. So what's he have to do? He has to attack.
Oh, no, and that's...
No, I love Ruby's just gung-ho approach at life here.
Let it rip.
And yeah. The two shots, the 15th and the 17th, were just like, you'll never see anything like it. But Harry Diamond, actually, I read today now, I presume it's true, but I read earlier on, that the line, they were driving back to the playoff hole on the back of the buggy, and Harry Diamond turned around to him real calm, almost like, obviously they're the best of mates, but almost like your mate down in the pub, and he says to him, we would have taken this on Monday morning, wouldn't we? And just pure simplifying it.
Yeah.
So right at the, whatever's gone on.
I know if I was Justin Rose, though, I'd have got off the buggy 100 yards in the tee box. I'd have made him wait. I'd have left him above the 18th for another minute or two anyway.
Yeah, the dark arts.
Also, the fact I mentioned him, he was amazing. Justin Rose was brilliant.
Just Rose. And the fact it was, the playoff was on the 18th. How cruel was that? Because usually I think it's on the 10th, or they used to start. So it might have changed it up at the Masters. So it was absolutely cruel.
If he went back down as fast as he went back down, if I was Justin Rose, I'd have left him waiting below anyway.
Kicking his heels.
Word in Shane Lowry as well, of course. A great few rounds and a disappointing end.
Oh. Disaster for him yesterday,
yeah,
wasn't it?
It was a terrible, terrible end. You do feel for him.
I felt for him with the media question on the Saturday, and I loved his response. And he was right to respond like that because he's in the heat of battle as well. Yet all he wanted to ask him was about Rory.
He was right, Alan, but it was probably the wrong time. And it's hard to say now that it didn't rattle him.
Oh, he was rattled. Yeah.
Also, he probably, ironically, given out about sticking the mic in front of your face, is like, you've given a raw and honest interview, so we're going to do it all the time now. That's going to be your answer. 51552 is the text number. Rory McIlroy is the greatest sports person the island of Ireland has ever produced. Career Grand Slam, first European to do it. Who knows what he will end up. A global sport like golf, like every sports achievement, you need to give it context and perspective. And many people play it. It is popular. Has it ever been done before? Well, it has. Rory McIlroy is an all-time great. And also, just to mention as well, Alex Dunn, Paul from Sligo texts in. Don't forget, Alex Dunn from Offaly, who won the Formula 2 race in Bahrain yesterday as well. We didn't get to go through our sporting highlights or even mention Talca Park on Friday, but however, or Ockram, but we will get to Gaelic football and everything else very shortly. Lady Luck offered herself up to a lot of demons of Rory, but he reckoned this was going to be part of it en route, and I think that stood to him. Some others fell badly, I thought. Fair play to his perseverance. It's unreal, says JK. Unsure if that's our own JK from Orchard. We are taking
There's only one JK, he's on board.
We are taking a short ad break and then we're turning our attention to football. Lots to get through, Alan. League of Ireland, Premier League, and even the Home Farm under 12s in big action against the Orchard tonight. Stay with us here on Game On.
Game On. Association football.
Now, we are chatting football. Alan Cawley, we'll keep it brief because I know you have a big match this evening, the Home Farm under 12s to be coaching on. You're not serving your touchline ban just yet, I believe. I know you'll probably want to stick the boot into Manchester United, but let's start on a positive note. Liverpool grinding out a victory like champions do. How impressive were they in your humble opinion?
Yeah, I think that sums it up very well, Shane, because they did grind it out. The first half, probably first 20 minutes, half an hour, well on top, got the goal and you thought like they were going to kick on there. But West Ham came back into the latter part of the first half and it was all West Ham in the second half, and Liverpool were poor enough, Shane, to be honest with you. And then to concede a really sloppy goal, a misunderstanding with Robertson and Van Dijk, something you don't see too often from Van Dijk, but it looked like he was at fault because by Robertson's reaction, I think he gave him a loud call. And then it won all, you're thinking, kind of, even though they're going to get over the line, that's the point. Arsenal slipping up on Saturday, they're going to win the league, but you'd want to be winning them with a bit of a swagger, especially at home, and that certainly wasn't the case in that second half. But then they got up the pitch, won a corner, and Van Dijk stepped up just when you need him with a brilliant goal. He's so dangerous from set pieces. So as you say, they grounded out, but the league's over, Shane. It really is.
Manchester United's season over? Perhaps not. They could have a big result on Thursday against Lyon and go on to European greatness. However, how...
What, if Leon don't get on the bus or get on the plane, or how exactly is that going to happen?
No, I've high hopes that I expected, not that my opinion carries much weight, but I expected them to get absolutely hopped off at the weekend, which they did. But I fully expect them to redeem themselves on Thursday.
I wouldn't be so sure, to be honest with you, Shane.
No?
They should be beating Leon, but I wouldn't be very confident about it. When you only have to watch this team just to see kind of how poor they are. Now, Newcastle are very good. I'm a big fan of Newcastle. Newcastle's midfield, you could do with those three playing for Manchester United in the midfield, Joe Linton, Tonali and Bruno Guimaraes. Them three are as good as you'll get around the league. Then you have Isak as well, should be playing for Manchester United. In the olden days, you'd have all the best players like that. But these are playing for Newcastle with a brilliant manager under Eddie Howe, and they're having a great season, got themselves into the top four with the win. But Manchester United, and I'm not sure if anyone saw it, there's so much emphasis, and it goes back to our conversation around Rory McIlroy and the mentality and the character and resilience. And nowadays there's so much of an emphasis on tactical breakdowns and formations and systems. But Roy Keane's comments yesterday will give you the best insight that you'll ever hear in terms of an analysis on a group of players showing zero accountability, or a culture that's just kind of haphazard, or there's an acceptance for mediocrity, something that he never had, that he never was involved in, or he was never around an environment like that. And he was pointing out all those examples of good teammates and exactly what a good teammate is. When you've Bruno Guimaraes or Bruno Fernandes coming out doing an interview, and he basically used the phrase that it was only sound bites, which was all it is, focusing on a game Thursday rather than focusing on the league game that they've just played, having a horrendous season, showing no accountability whatsoever for the concession of the goals, or pinpointing fingers at the likes of Dalot and how poor he's been. And I remember it being in here weeks ago, Shane, there was a game against Brentford and he was the exact same in a concession of a goal from a set piece. And if you're allowing these things happen and patterns kind of emerge through these kind of mistakes and no one's pulled up on them, this is the result. And that's what we're seeing time after time. Onana's making mistake after mistake. Harry Maguire, I mentioned it weeks ago, making mistake after mistake, yet they rewarded him with an extension to a contract. These are the reasons Manchester United are an absolute shambles. And if anyone listened to the Keane quotes and the comments yesterday, it was an unbelievable insight just in terms of what he was involved in and the kind of rubbish that we're watching with Manchester United now.
Yeah. You mentioned
Spurs aren't going much better, Al.
No, they're worse. But they don't have a Roy Keane figure to point out the things, because they've been poor for years and years. But just in terms of Postecoglou, and he's been annoying me for a while, to be honest with you, Ruby, He's almost playing the victim every week.
You haven't mentioned it on air.
In the sense that he's coming out almost kind of going against the fans pointing out that why are the negative, or why is there negativity around this team? There's negativity because they've lost 17 matches out of 32, and again the concession of 4 goals. I think it's the first time Wolves have scored more than 2 all season, yet to concede 4 against Spurs. So, and again, they're in a similar vein of form to United, pointing at, oh, Thursday night's the big night. I can't see them beating Eintracht Frankfurt either, and he'll be out the door past the Coglu.
Starting to worry about Spurs, Al. Oh, not Spurs, Forest. They're starting to wobble.
They're starting to wobble, Ruby, yeah. And again, the trend of the show, all about character, resilience, they have to really dig in now. They're still in a strong enough position, but they're queuing up behind them. Obviously, Newcastle probably in great form, as we see, only a point behind. They have a game in hand as well. City on 55, a big win for City. I was surprised, to be honest, which I fancied Crystal Palace, and Palace were 2-0 up, and obviously City came back with a brilliant victory. But if they can just hang in, Ruby, what's left? Like, there's only
six games.
If they can just hang in, but they're in a strong position. Again, to go back to Harry Diamond's comment, they would have taken this at the start of the season, Nottingham Forest, to be sitting third with 6 games to go. They would have snapped their hands off. So hopefully they can just dig in. I know it's 2 defeats now, and that was a disappointing one against Everton. Whatever about losing to Villa the week before, who were a very good team, but that was a disappointing one on Saturday, home to Everton. But hopefully they can just dig in and try and get the job done.
You know what the bad news is, Al?
Who did play next?
They're going to end up finishing 8th.
They won't, lads. They
need
won't.
To just play on the front foot like Ruby Moore.
Newcastle, City, Chelsea and Villa would all get in front of them.
Attack. Listen, before we let you go, will Cork City show a bit of resilience away to Shamrock Rovers this evening?
No, I can't see it. Shamrock Rovers will win.
Okay, fair enough.
You said
and
short.
There you have it.
Over and out.
Just mentioned as well, you mentioned Newcastle. Newcastle boss Eddie Howe has thanked fans for their messages and warm wishes after the club announced he is recovering in hospital after being diagnosed with pneumonia. So we send our best wishes to Eddie Howe. Al, thank you very
much for popping in.
Best of luck to the home farm. Against Cherry Orchard. We'll hear all about it on Friday. We are taking a short ad break. Austin O'Malley is patiently standing by, and there won't be any more chat about home farm. It's all about Gaelic football after the break.
Game on. Gaelic football.
Welcome back to Game On, and it was Newbridge or Nowhere on Saturday night. Kildare came from behind to beat Westmead, and the first goal, Austin O'Malley, I thought was what the new rules in GAA football are all about.
Yeah, no, listen, it was a cracker, and it was such a big score as well in the context of the game, because Westmeath had opened really brightly and they had Kildare in a little bit of batter early doors in terms of their press and their kick out, but it was a super ball into Byrne, and my God, when he won it, he still had a fair bit to do, but he absolutely unleashed a thunderbolt, and it was just a rocket, and it was a huge score in the context of the game, and it really, I suppose, re-energised Kildare. But it is absolutely what the new rules are about, that long diagonal ball in, and having somebody that with the ability of Byrne to win it, but the finish then was just a rocket. So it was a brilliant score.
But even the excitement of the contest is what it's about, to me anyway.
Yeah, no, and like it was such an even contest as well. When you've seen, like, you know, it was a 2-point win for Kildare, but you know they obviously swapped leads a number of times, but there was so much in it in terms of, I suppose, Westmeath starting really positively on the front foot, and I suppose we can't let the game go without mentioning Luke Loughlin. He had a superb performance for Westmeath, 11 points across the 70 minutes, but Kildare, you know, they just managed to hold in there, and I thought they showed a good bit of character in that second half, and they dug themselves out, even the likes of Davy Hyland getting forward for that goal and that. But there was probably a pivotal moment in the game in terms of Westmeath losing Ray Kennellan, which gave, he was Lord in disguise really, and he was dominating that middle sector, and when he went, Callum Bolton and Kevin Feely really grew into the game, and they got a foothold there, and it's, you know, it kind of gave them a little bit more energy and oxygen and possession to get forward. So they'll be, Brian Flanagan would be very, very happy to get out of there. I think it was the first time in 30 years that there was a championship game in Kildare, so it was a big night. Stadium looked fantastic, and there was a great crowd and a great atmosphere. I was down there at it. I really, really enjoyed it. But as you said at the outset, it was just a really even contest, and that's what we're looking for. And great to see these Leinster quarterfinals taken out of Croke Park and them in them county venues.
Yeah, most certainly. And the semi-finals as well will be in Portlaoise and Tullamore. And from what you saw in Ockham and Navan, could Meath rattle Dublin in a semi-final?
Yeah, Dublin were sluggish. They certainly were not up and at it to what you'd expect. I think, you know, coming away from it, I thought, you know, they really looked like a team that were just using the game for a tune-up, even though Desi Farrell would said afterwards he was really disappointed in terms of the performance level. But I think a lot of it had to do with Wicklow. Wicklow were superb across the 70 minutes in terms of what they brought, their the fight, the courage, the tenacity. A couple of their guys really stood up. Dean Healy was immense throughout. Like, he kicked 4 points, and it was just it was a performance of bold defiance from him. And also young Oisin McGrainer in the corner weighed in with a couple of huge scores. So Dublin were slightly off it in terms of their kick out came under a lot of pressure. I thought Hugh O'Sullivan, who was only catapulted in to start from, he's a Ballyboden club man, he was under pressure. They were under pressure around the middle in terms of even the second phase and breaking ball and that. So Wicklow brought an awful lot of, to that game. But Dublin obviously have a lot more to come. And, Paddy Small entered the fray late on, and Killian McGuinness. So obviously Conn, I thought, stood up really well. He hit 1-7 over the 70 minutes as well. But Dublin have a bit of work to do. And just looking from what happened in Navan in terms of that sort of, was it a 17-point swing where Meath came back in and won. Meath will pose a lot more problems to Dublin than obviously Wicklow did, and particularly their ability to kick 2-pointers. When you look at what Matthew Costlow, given that it was wind assisted, but he still has that in his locker. Huge turnaround and a brilliant win for Meath there.
Absolutely. We have ran out of road. Of course, Tyrone defeated Cavan, and Antrim did put it up to Armagh, but Armagh did emerge victorious. There's more Gaelic football chat in the RTE Sport podcast with Peter Canavan, Rory O'Neill and Jackie Hurley. Unfortunately, you can blame a fellow Ulster man for his not being able to get to it on this evening show as well. Their chat about Rory, understandable. Austin Maddy, thank you so much for popping in to studio. Ruby, who is up next? Rachel May Hannon with the new music show is up next, so do stay tuned to 2FM. Massive thank you to our broadcast coordinator, Laura Lee Davis. This evening's programme was produced by Ronan Lawler. Coming up tomorrow, Paul Corrie, Mark Langdon will chat football, we'll review the weekend's rugby and preview the upcoming URC fixtures and plenty more besides. For myself, Ruby, and all of the Game On team, it is bye for now.